Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. This episode is a conversation with Alvaro Oreart, who is a researcher at the Université Libre de Bruxelles. Alvaro has deep knowledge and expertise about the Conference on the Future of Europe. He's writing a book about it. In this conversation, he shares his impressions and insights gleaned as an observer of the conference process from the inside. I hope you find it as fascinating as I did. All right, I'm here in conversation with Alvaro Oreart of the Université Libre de Bruxelles. He's a researcher there, and he's been doing a lot of research lately on the Conference on the Future of Europe, which is the subject of this Amplify podcast series. Alvaro, welcome.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Ian.
So nice to see you. And I guess maybe a good way to start this conversation is just to ask you to describe from your own perspective what the Conference on the Future of Europe was.
So the Conference on the Future of Europe was a process that was launched in 2021 in the midst of COVID that lasted for 1 year. And the goal of the conference was to, in some ways, put forward the priorities that citizens would have in regards to the future of European integration. And the hope was that there would be some sort of follow-up from the three institutions. The Conference on the Future of Europe was departed from an interinstitutional agreement between the European Commission, the Council, and the European Parliament, that there would be some sort of follow-up. And the three institutions led the whole process through a sort of task force that was called the Common Secretariat that was conformed by members of the officials of the three institutions, and they sort of steered the whole process of the conference. The conference during this 1 year included four citizen panels of 200 people each of the panels. These 200 people were randomly selected. They followed deliberative methods. Each of the panels was focused on different policy areas. And this conference added an innovative layer, which is that 20 out of these 200 people from each of the panels were selected as ambassadors, citizen ambassadors that would go on to a plenary session in which they would get to interact with members of the European Parliament, the Commission, the Council, national parliamentarians, civil society, and they would sort of play a role in the negotiations between the different institutions. And ultimately, all this process would end up with a set of 49 recommendations that was endorsed by all the different elements of the conference, including the Commission, Council, Parliament, national parliaments, and the citizen component.
Right. And then, as we were discussing before, the just last Friday, so that was December 2nd, there was a feedback session that involved a number of these citizens came back to, they came to Brussels, I guess, to kind of 6 months later review like where the process stands. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. I've got a side question. I've just the Conference on the Future of Europe had this kind of collective leadership, a bit maybe cumbersome. These three institutions all kind of had their hands on the process. I remember before the conference started, there was an idea that there should be one single person to act as chair, like a strong personality, like Giscard d'Estaing did in the European Convention in the early 2000s. But that didn't happen. Do you think that would have made a difference if they had a single strong personality?
I am not sure it would have made a difference. So when the conference was initially pitched by Ursula von der Leyen was when she was making the argument to be elected as president of the European Commission, in spite of the fact that she was not a Spitzenkandidat. And initially, she hinted that the conference would be led uniquely by the European Parliament. However, this did not happen, and ultimately it became a sort of interinstitutional agreement. So, I mean, I guess it would have been made a difference if that one person would have been able to speak on behalf of the three institutions. But I don't see any person that would have been able to play that role, to be honest, because the disagreements across the different institutions were just too big.
Right. Okay. Well, that's kind of that's an academic question now, but it's historically, it's kind of an interesting kind of counterfactual. Anyway, coming now to the, so let's talk more about these citizens panels. Mm-hmm. Now, can you explain your involvement with one of these four citizens panels? Which one was it, and how were you involved?
Yeah, so basically I was involved actually in two of them. I was basically an observer across two of the four panels. One was on democracy and rule of law and security and values, which was panel two. And then there was panel four, which was EU in the world and migration. And I mainly played the role of as an academic observer to the conference, but I also played a slight role as well as an organizer, because in panel four in EU and migration, the panel was being the last session of the panel was being organized in Maastricht. So in my institution, so I was playing an important role in terms of discussing with the Common Secretariat and the organizers of the conference about, it was mainly about the logistics. I didn't play a role on in terms of the substance of it. That was not up to me. But I played sort of with a double hat, on the one hand as an observer, but also partially as an organizer.
Right. And so just so listeners get a pardon me, get a sense of what an interesting kind of process this is. The citizens panel's got 200 people who are randomly chosen from across the entire 27 EU member states.
Yeah.
And they are demographically representative of all of Europe, with overrepresentation for youth.
Yeah.
Right. I think one third of the citizens panels were. What age? 18 to 24, was it?
It was, I think, 16 to 25.
Right. Okay. So that's the only, otherwise they're pretty much supposed to be a kind of representative sample of Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although, was it equal representation from each member state?
Yeah, in principle, the idea was to have a more proportional representation. So obviously, there would be more people from Spain than from Malta, let's say. But the idea was indeed to get a more or less proportional sample of the EU population within these 200 people.
Right. Do you think they were successful in that?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I think it's a very difficult process. So in that sense, I mean, the logistics of doing such an exercise, I think, requires a lot of effort. So I think that in some ways, yeah, I think more or less, I know that some of my colleagues have some reservations in terms of the way in which this selection was done, because, for example, it was not taking into account the views on the EU. So the argument is that people that will agree to do this sort of process will be more or less more naturally oriented towards a pro-EU bias, because there was not a question that that was put forward. To be honest, I think that that the process are already very complicated. And in that sense, I think more or less you could get a grasp. I mean, obviously there was a slight, I guess, bias towards higher education. Most of the people had education of university level. And I guess that in terms of socioeconomic, it was a rather middle to upper class, just because it requires to travel, it requires mostly to speak languages because people would speak in their own languages, like they could speak, but obviously people that would not speak other languages are more likely to say no to this. And it's true that we don't have the turnover rate. So we don't know exactly, you know, how many people they asked, how many people said no, and so on.
Right. So there's a certain selection bias just in the fact that the kind of people that would come to this kind of a meeting are not necessarily your perfectly average compared to the population at large.
I mean, that's an argument to be made. I am not sure. I myself would depart from my own position that I'm not an expert on mini publics. I am that. That's what some of my colleagues have said. But yeah, my sense is that broadly there was a certain diversity. It's true that, for example, in terms of ethnic minorities and so on, I think that there was clearly an underrepresentation. But at the same time, you know, it's difficult. To actually make sure that there is some sort of equality there, because, you know, some countries do not provide that data. So how are you going to get it, et cetera, et cetera? So I think there are a lot of challenges in making that selection. So I think that that's a really tough process.
That's a common thing in European institutions. They think the fact that you've got 27 member states and citizens from 27 member states, that's diversity. That's enough diversity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's in some ways, I think a mistake. At the same time, I also acknowledge the difficulties in making that diversity in those 200 people. So, but yeah, okay. There were certainly some shortcomings there.
Okay. So anyway, that's just a matter of the people, how the people were selected. But let's talk more about the actual process of the meetings. Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, there were three, that each citizens panel met three times. Mm-hmm. And it was once the first one was in Strasbourg. Second was online.
Yeah.
And the third one was in a different city.
Yeah.
And the ones that you observed were in Florence and Maastricht.
Yeah.
And so in each case, they were lasted 2 days, 3 days?
3 days, Friday to Sunday.
3 days. Now, in real time, mm-hmm. you're there observing this and seeing, do you see deliberation happening before your mm-hmm. eyes?
So yes, I mean, I do see deliberation in some ways. I am also critical of the process, but just to explain a little bit the logic of these three sessions. So all four panels follow the same sort of methodology, right? Even though they were dealing with different topics, the methodology implemented was in principle the same. Obviously, there was some sort of lessons learning at every point. So, for example, you know, when the first session of panel one took place, for the first session of panel two, there were some lessons that were being learned. So I think that the sense of, in some ways, constant improvisation was also there. Was at least that sense of the common secretariat constantly jockeying around to improvise and so on was always there. To a certain extent, because there were conflicts between the three institutions, and the fact that they include so many topics. So, for example, panel one, the one that ended in Dublin, was on education, youth, culture, sports, jobs. I mean, it was massive, right? So the reason why those policy areas were all addressed was because they would not be able to agree between the three institutions what would be the key issues to be addressed in the citizen panel. So they say, okay, since we cannot agree, let's do all of them, basically, right? Right.
So this is a good moment to bring a this question of like agenda setting.
Mm-hmm.
So from one perspective, I heard it described as citizens were supposed to, it was even deciding what goes on the agenda was supposed to be led by the citizens themselves. Like it was supposed to be kind of a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
Yet they did have, there was like this what was it? A joint declaration or something like that. That was that between the three institutions that did set an agenda. But it was super broad.
It was super broad in a way that it was very difficult for the citizen panels to have very concrete kind of recommendations. And I mean, to be fair, I think often citizen panels, citizen assemblies are done on specific topics. So I don't know, the most famous in Ireland, right, on abortion or gay marriage. I mean, in many ways, it was a discussion of different choices, right? And then you would have arguments in favor of one choice, people on the other, and then would be deliberation around. And here the exercise is more of a wish list exercise. So the goal of the citizen panels is to sort of come up with recommendations that then EU institutions could follow up on it. But then to come back to a little bit the logic of the different sessions in the panels, the first session indeed was meant to be a sort of blank sheet, right? Then, you know, you as citizens decide what is relevant within the scope of this specific, within this specific topic, right? However, already in the first session, you already had, and actually that was the most important dimension of the first session, you had experts that would be invited to provide input within the scope of the policy area they were dealing with. Now, I mean, that's a separate chapter is about, you know, how the selection of experts was undertaken. And that is very complex, but broadly, while the Common Secretariat was sort of taking the decisions of all the elements, the whole conference was sort of co-chaired by the three institutions, by representatives of Parliament, Council, in this case, the presidency in its time. Of the Council and the Commission. I think basically they were, between the three institutions, they were deciding who the experts that would provide input would be. Now, an interesting choice is that they made that the experts were framed as being quote unquote neutral. So there was not a sort of contradictory debate between different views from experts in regards to democratic backsliding, to put it like that. But there were kind of separate interventions that would not necessarily overlap with each other. So you could see that there were some sort of different views, but because the scope of the panels was so broad, in the end, the different experts were sort of talking about different things. But that gives a lot of power to those experts that were already setting up a little bit the framework in which the different citizens would do the discussions during the first session of the panel.
Were the experts, if like just looking at the axis of promoting more Europe versus less Europe, were the experts biased towards more Europe?
I mean, I would probably say yes, but I don't feel that's entirely fair in the sense that it was not as explicit as that. I mean, to put an example, some of the experts, well, former people related to the Commission, people related to the Parliament, and obviously some of those actors that are related in one way or another to those institutions, I would assume that they have some sympathies towards that direction. And it's true that in most of the interventions, there was some sort of, I mean, I would not necessarily say there was a sort of more integration bias in that open way. What I find maybe slightly problematic is that the citizens that were confronted with these experts were not in some ways given some sort of framework to make sense of what the different positions in regards to EU integration are. So they encountered the experts without that previous background. Also because that previous background, the three institutions could not agree on what that background would be. So in the end, the outcome was we provide them no background and we just give them the experts.
Right. So you couldn't give them a lecture about intergovernmentalism versus supranationalism as two different approaches to European integration.
Not really, no. I mean, I'm not sure a lecture would have helped, but I mean, I think especially at that first stage, it would have been interesting, for instance, for the citizens, participants to know what the position of the European People's Party is in regards to more integration, democratic backsliding, and like that, the same position that what the position is of the Social Democrats, of the Renew Group, of the Greens. And in that way, I think you would have provided citizens with a sort of broader background of what the different positions are. And instead, they left them a little bit in a more abstract position and suddenly encountering some of the experts. And there was a very wide variety. I mean, some of the experts, I do recall some of the experts that were trying to be a bit more academic, so trying to be more descriptive and so on, whereas others were, no, actually, what you have to do is this and that, right? For example, in regards to unanimity, which, to be honest, I mean, I am also in favor of getting rid of unanimity in the council and so on. It's just that I think that the previous background was not entirely fully explained in the beginning, and that left, I mean, I did many interviews with citizens, that left many citizens a little bit not fully understanding, grasping the existing conflicts between the three institutions, between the different political parties, between the different political visions, between business and trade unions. So all that kind of was there, but not really there to be grasped.
And is that maybe a symptom of the fact that the agenda was so broad? So you can imagine, like, citizens, if you give them a focus, if you had just a citizens panel debate trying to decide about recommendations about getting rid of unanimity, and they debated for 2 days just about that question, they probably would come up with some pretty focused, they would grasp the issue in its entirety, and they probably come up with some pretty focused recommendations. Whereas unanimity was just one of many, many issues, and institutional questions and policy questions kind of got muddled together, did they?
Exactly. I mean, I recall, for example, I don't recall the exact phrasing of the recommendation in regards to unanimity in panel 2, which was the one that I followed in Democracy and Rule of Law that ended in Florence. But I do recall that the final phrasing was some sort of rethink unanimity in the council. So because in some ways, I mean, we can get there as well. But because of this abstract nature of the exercise, the recommendations tended to be also rather broad in many ways. Because to finish a little bit the background on the session, so the first session, it was sort of a blank sheet. And during those first 3 days, the different citizens were put forward in, they had the plenary sessions with the experts, but they also were working in different smaller groups. Within those smaller groups, they were discussing what the priorities of the EU should be, or for them, they should be, in a sort of deliberative way. And the outcome of that first session would be some sort of agenda setting that was called streams. And those set of streams, then they were carried on to the second session. So the second session started from the streams that were constructed on the basis of the input of the first session. This second session online was a little bit more focused on those streams. So the citizens were already discussing within the range of the different streams that were identified in the first session. And from there, they went on to create almost not recommendations, but what was the name? They went on to create a more narrow set of streams that were almost recommendations, were sort of proposals. And then in the third session, when they met in person, they went on to draft specific recommendations. And that exercise, I mean, basically the exercise started from a very broad perspective of, you know, what are your priorities in this policy area, towards being very specific of drafting a specific recommendation that would be sent to the citizen ambassadors that they would negotiate in the plenary.
Okay. Well, that's really, really helpful that you explained that so clearly. So you can see the process, how they went from very a broad agenda to narrowing it down into streams, and then finally into concrete recommendations that were, and were those recommendations voted on in the citizens panel?
Yes. So basically, in the third session, the citizens were divided in different working groups. In each of the working groups was focused on a specific element. So I don't know, EU decision making, for example, would be one of the working groups. And those working groups would in parallel draft specific recommendations. Now, a problematic element is that each of the working groups develop its own recommendations, and they didn't necessarily consult with the other working groups. So there was a session that was called the feedback session, in which some of the representatives from each of the working groups would present the recommendations they had been working on to another working group. But that didn't work really well, and it was also very, very close on timing. Everything went very quick. But ultimately, those recommendations that each of the working groups agreed upon, they were put to a general vote of the whole 200 citizens, and they had to cross the barrier of 70%. So if 70%, each of the different recommendations with its justification, so they were working not only at the drafting of the recommendation, but also on the justification behind that recommendation, that was read in a plenary session, and then the whole 200 citizen participants would vote on the recommendations, and those that would surpass the 70%, then they would count as official recommendations from that panel.
And do you recall approximately how many passed and how many didn't pass?
Yeah, it was an overwhelming majority they passed. So in each of the panels, and that was arguably one of the issues, there were just too many recommendations. And almost all of them, I mean, maybe I think out of between 40 and 50 that each panel came up with, maybe four or five were voted down. And those that were voted down were also by a small margin. So mostly it was also a sense of collective ownership that you would sense that there was some sort of solidarity with the different working groups that, well, if my fellow panelists have been working on this, you know, I kind of support it. So that sense of collective ownership was arguably present in those processes. And I would argue that's mainly why most of the recommendations passed.
That's very interesting. Okay, so, and one more quick question about the citizens panels. Mm-hmm. The use of expertise on the citizens panels, there was also, I recall we discussed this mm-hmm. previously, that there wasn't all the people on the citizens panels weren't always able to kind of just get good information about factual information mm-hmm. about what the European Union already does.
That was a big part of the problem, I would argue, that as we were discussing, because it started from a sort of blank sheet perspective, most of the citizens lacked the background of what the EU is already doing in that specific policy area. So many times they were suggesting things that would already be existing or would be in the process and so on. And because the three institutions were sort of in a constant jockeying mode between each other, they would not necessarily agree on, you know, what is considered to be factual information. So ultimately, right. Ultimately, what they did, they set up as of the second session, a set of fact checkers. And the fact checkers would be people that would be listening to the conversations, and they would notice if something is incorrect from the discussion, from if some one of the person says something that is factually incorrect, then that would be sort of fact checked and so on. Problem, of course, of all this is that when that fact check arrived, it was always late. So, you know, the discussion was already moved on to somewhere else. And also there was some sort of sense that the three institutions were very, very, very sensitive to anything that was being discussed. So they were very closely following all the conversations. And there was, I would argue, a general attitude to being very skeptical of any input that might enter the conversation of the citizens that they could not control.
So you have these fact checkers, and that's separate from the moderators and the facilitators who are there just to keep the conversation going. And that's a different kind of skill, but that they didn't see it as their role in actually sort of making sure that the citizens had all the correct information.
I mean, to be fair, the moderators were not, I mean, there were some that were experts on EU policy, but there were also some moderators whose expertise was the moderation part. Because, I mean, there's a long kind of literature on mini publics and so on that, well, sometimes moderators should not be have a long expertise on the subject because they might bias the conversation and so on. So the moderators would not necessarily be always experts, so they would actually not necessarily always know whether something was correct or not. In other cases, there were some moderators that were actual experts, like people, political scientists, on specialized on the EU, but not always. So there was a slight inequality in terms of the type of moderators that was doing this process. And then you also had the observers that could operate as a sort of fact checker. So we as observers, we were also asked, you know, if you see something that is incorrect being discussed, please send us an email and so on. Now, the issue is that yet again, I mean, for example, in the third session, there were both observers and experts. The experts, they were invited to be in the room, but they could not speak. So you would get a little bit this paradox that even when citizens would be asking for some information, background information about a particular policy, and the expert would be in the room, the expert would not be allowed to speak because he or her input would have to go through the filter to make sure that input is quote unquote neutral. This is a little bit what I mean with the sensitivity of some of the institutions in sort of being aware of every single input that enters the discussion.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. So we've talked about the citizens panels quite a lot. So let's turn to the plenary. Now, the plenary was meeting kind of in parallel to this, I think met seven times in total, and a lot of those meetings were hampered by COVID-19, and a lot of them took place in a hybrid format, I understand. What was your impression of the plenary?
So the plenary, all the organizers emphasized that the plenary was the most innovative part of the conference rather than the panels, because the plenary was composed of the traditional components, so national parliaments, European parliamentarians, commission, council, but also some of the citizen ambassadors. So in the first session of each of the four panels, there was a sort of lottery in which all the citizen participants could put forward their sort of candidacy to become a citizen ambassador, and by sortition again, and as well following kind of representative idea. So there would be, I don't know, 16 to 25, there would be a box of 16 to 25 people. So you would put your candidacy there and there would be X amount of people taken from there. So 20 out of those 200 would be sort of elected via sortition to participate as citizen ambassadors in the plenary session.
When you say elected by sortition, that's chosen at random.
Yeah.
They weren't elected by their fellow citizens panelists as representatives. Okay, that's very interesting. I did not realize that. So you have citizens that are chosen at random out of the citizens panels, 20 from each, that go to the plenary. Now the plenary, and the idea behind the plenary is that there's I don't remember the exact numbers, but we're talking about 400 people or something in total. Yeah. And more than 100 citizens, 20 from each panel, and then a few others. I can't remember exactly where they came from. So this is an interesting facet of it, because in the Citizens Assembly in Ireland, you have the citizens, they do their work, they present their recommendations, but then their work ends. They don't take part, they don't present their work to the politicians. As I understand it, whereas in this case the citizens were actually there to, I won't say confront is not the right word, but come into direct contact with the politicians and actually present their recommendations. So how did that go?
So it went, I would say it had it had some positive elements, it had some negative ones. So just to be clear, so there were 80 from citizen ambassadors from the citizen panels, but there were also national citizen panels. So we didn't discuss this, but basically in the conference, they opened the possibility for member states to organize their own national citizen panels that had to follow a certain criteria. And if they followed that criteria, they would be able to send some of those people from those national citizen panels to as well the plenary. So they were as part of the citizens component, and it was not only the European citizen panelists, but also some national citizen panelists. Now, this was not followed by all EU member states. Actually, I don't recall the exact number, but I think it was around 5 or 6 member states that organized it. So it was represented from those member states that actually did it. Now, in terms of how it worked, so the first plenary session was a disaster because basically they brought the citizens to provide 1 minute inputs into the European Parliament, and it would not be organized thematically. So I think this must have been in November or December 2021, if I recall correctly. Basically the citizens were given 1 minute statements, and you would see a change of topic from gender equality to then energy and climate change to then youth and sports. So there was not really sort of a deliberative aspect to it, but just citizens coming up and providing that 1 minute statement. So that I think the conference secretariat, they realized that was not really working. So progressively they changed a little bit the way of working of the plenary session. They established 9 working groups that were separated by policy areas. So there would be, for example, a working group on democracy, there would be a working group on health, and so on. And then within that working group, the panelists that were working on that issue, then they were present in that working group that was at the same time being composed of members of the different institutions that we outlined earlier. It was very mixed. Mainly, I mean, there were several elements. So the first element is that MEPs, especially, let's say EU institutions were not necessarily prepared to include a new actor in the scene, right? So suddenly you get a lot of citizen panelists that arrive there and have all these proposals, but are not entirely socialized with EU institutions, with the codes that EU institutions have when working together. So for example, there was a case in which each of the working groups would be chaired by someone from the institutions, right? So for example, the democracy working group, which is the one that I followed closer, was Manfred Weber. And I'm not saying it happened on this one, but there was one chair that suddenly was calling people by their names, by their given names. And then they would be, because they would know each other, but they would call other people by their sort of family name just because, yeah. So obviously there was some socialization on both sides, but especially I would argue probably on the side of EU institutions and people that were not used to having a new actor on the scene.
Right, but this is what was innovative about it. It's like, yeah, you're supposed to bring the citizens like directly into the room with the politicians. So it's made for an interesting encounter, but sometimes very much a clash of cultures.
Exactly. And now another issue was that, for example, civil society actors were initially not included in the conference, plenary, but they, in response to their sidelining, they created what a sort of coalition called the Civil Society Convention. And out of that statement, joint coalition that many civil society actors put forward, then they were included with some seats in the plenary, but nearly not enough even to cover all working groups. So civil society really lost a lot of positioning. And in some ways, it seems the institutions created a framework in which it was easy for civil society to feel some sort of competition from the citizen ambassadors in terms of the legitimacy that was going on. Now, to be fair, this didn't play out in practice because most of the citizen recommendations were actually quite well aligned with most civil society actors present there, as well as the trade unions. But it was notable. I think it's an important point to put that civil society was largely in some ways sidelined from the process, and they had to sort of push to be included, similar with trade unions. And to a certain extent as well with what I know is one of your main interests, with national parliamentarians. So COSAC was more or less involved throughout the conference, but only very few national parliamentarians were actually active in that process because they were brought in very late. And in a very, let's say, non-cohesive way. So it was out of the more interest of the national parliamentarians to be involved rather than a more structural involvement of national parliaments as such in the conference.
Right. And I think because their representation was large, there were four from each national parliament. So there's 108 altogether. But you didn't think that they formed a cohesive group or made a decisive intervention?
I think it was very difficult because you didn't really have debates in national parliaments about the future of Europe. So national parliamentarians would go there and would more or less provide their opinion, but it was very difficult for national parliamentarians to say, this is the position of national parliaments. Right. So in some ways they would be speaking a little bit sort of out of their own perspectives, but not necessarily as representatives from, you know, the views of national parliaments. I mean, instead, the European Parliament, the Council, the Commission had a much, let's say, tighter kind of views, a much more cohesive perspective. Whereas a bit national parliamentarians, well, it depends who you asked. because there was a wide diversity in that sense.
Yeah, and that's a more general problem in for national parliaments trying to get their voices heard in the European Union. So the plenary, they wrapped up their work. They adopted all of these recommendations. These recommendations that were brought forward by the citizens, most, as I understand it, most or maybe all of those ended up getting adopted by the plenary.
No.
So, okay, sorry.
So basically, the recommendations that came out of each of the citizen panels was, to put it in some ways, the mandate that citizen ambassadors had in order to negotiate with other institutions. Right. So the citizen ambassadors, for example, from the panel of European democracy, they would have the recommendations from the panel, and they would depart from that position, but they would have to negotiate with other EU institutions. And a key role in that sense was played by the chair of the different working groups. So you would get actually quite diversity. For example, in the working group on health that was chaired by Maros Šefčovič, the vice president of the commission, it was rather consensual, and it seems that things work pretty well. Whereas, for example, the working group that I followed on democracy, chaired by Manfred Weber, MEP from the European People's Party, it was a constant clash between different actors. Also, I guess it's the nature of the topic. It's a more contentious topic, and, you know, the future of European democracy in comparison to health, especially after the pandemic and so on. But you could see a very different approach between different chairs, and that would make a lot of difference.
Can I ask you a bit more about that? Of course, in an alternate universe, Manfred Weber could be the president of the European Commission.
Yeah.
Right, because he was the Spitzenkandidat that was rejected by the European Council, and he, in the run-up to the 2019 elections, he got a lot of criticism for being soft on rule of law questions, in particularly in relation to Viktor Orban. So, what kind of role did he play, and what were the, if you recall, what were, where did you come down and? Democracy and the rule of law in that working group and the final result.
So I mean, I think Manfred Weber played actually a role of in some ways representing the position of the parliament, and I don't think, I mean, also taking into account, I mean, it's very relevant what you're saying, but at the same time, let's take into account that throughout the conference, Viktor Orban was no longer a member of EPP. Before the conference started, Fidesz, Orban's party, it was already out of EPP. So I don't think that Weber, in the context of the working group, was sort of positioning as kind of a complicating the democratic backsliders, addressing democratic backsliding in Hungary. What I think was most notable, perhaps, was that the way of working was following the typical codes of the European Parliament. So Manfred Weber and his assistants would have, you know, they would put forward the drafts of the things only in English. Not all the citizen ambassadors were fluent in English. It followed a relatively top down. So, you know, I send you this super long document, and I ask you to, you know, put comments in a Google Docs to make the amendments in page 3, paragraph 4, line 6. And obviously the citizen ambassadors were not, had to socialize first with this process, right? And we're complaining a lot about how this process functioned, because it clearly influenced, or let's say it facilitated the involvement of those actors that already understand how the process works. So the newcomers were a bit like, and there was a moment actually in which the citizen ambassadors were actually protesting and saying, well, you know, if we don't change how we work, we're not participating, we're boycotting the working group.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes, and there was a recess, and there was a change for good, I would argue. And then ultimately, there was some sort of happy ending. But this process was very contentious and was very difficult to manage.
Oh, that's fascinating. So in the end, they not all the recommendations. So recommendations had to sort of get filtered through the plenary, and then were voted on by the plenary.
Yes. Well, they were not. There was no vote involved. So Ultimately, what happened is that there was a set of recommendations coming from each of the working groups that was negotiated. So ultimately, there was no recommendation from the citizen panels that passed as such, right? So many of the recommendations in some ways were included, but not unfiltered, let's say, after negotiation. And ultimately, there was no vote. There was some sort of consensus voting by the different, what they called components. So there was the European Commission, the Council, the Parliament, national parliaments, and the citizen component, which was made out of the citizen ambassadors plus the national citizen ambassadors. And they more or less all agreed to that set of 49 recommendations that the conference report outlines.
Okay. So that's all fascinating. Now, this, I think we can now move to talk about the event that took place last Friday. So 6 months later, after the final meeting of the Conference on the Future of Europe, which took place on May 9th, and then the report was published and including all the recommendations. So what has happened since then, and how is the whole conference being followed up upon, including at this feedback session that happened last Friday?
Yeah, so basically, this feedback session was organized pretty short after the final involvement on the 9th of May. While it may seem very short after only 6 months, the argument that the organizers put forward was that some of the citizens that were involved, for example, in the democracy panel, their last involvement with the conference took place in December 2021, because most of the citizen panelists were not ambassadors, which means that most of them just never were actively involved in the conference afterwards. So that was the argument. And in some ways, I think that the institutions are relatively comfortable in arguing that they are already working on most of the things that the conference suggested. So, for example, the main thing, the European Commission is saying that they just a few weeks ago, they put forward the European Commission 2023 work program. And basically, the argument is that of that program, more or less 80% of it is sort of in some ways inspired by some of the work in the conference. At the same time, so there was that sort of specific policy follow-up that is being closely followed. And then there's also a process kind of response, which is that the European Commission has already agreed that they will be organizing three new citizen panels. The first one that actually starts in less than 2 weeks on food waste, then there will be one on learning mobility and one on virtual worlds.
Virtual worlds.
Yes. So okay. the metaverse.
Okay. Food waste, learning mobility.
Yeah.
And virtual worlds. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So three. So obviously, much more focused. But are they modeled on the citizens panels experience?
They are heavily modeled on the citizen panels. And also an important element that we didn't discuss yet is the who is organizing these panels, because it's not the commission, it's not any of the three institutions. The three institutions for the conference, they hired a consortium of companies and organizations that have the expertise of organizing these deliberative methods, led primarily by Mission Public, a French organization. And the same consortium will be also organizing the following citizen panels on this. So basically the argument that the institutions are saying, well, there's follow-up at the level of policies. So most of the commission policy program is now inspired by the conference. And we're also following up on these processes. We're setting up new citizen panels and so on. So that's the argument that they are making. Now, during the feedback event, there was a lot of contestation, but primarily between the three institutions, which was also interesting because and many of the citizens were in some way shocked because take into account that for this feedback session, they invited all 800 citizen panelists. Yes, so not only the citizen ambassadors.
So all 800 citizen panelists were invited to come to Brussels.
Yeah.
For this large meeting. And do you know approximately how many were there?
I think it was 535. So it was a pretty good turnout. I think most of the citizens enjoyed the experience and they were enthusiastic about participating in it. But at the same time, they were also, many of them, critical of the whole process. And some of them were, in fact, in some ways, surprised by the explicit conflicts between the three institutions, because many of them had not realized that conflict, because all this interinstitutional struggle that I described earlier, in some ways, was in the background. It was not visible for the citizens, right? And that's what I'm saying, you know, you would not know which experts had been invited by the commission or by the council, right? So there was all this background struggle between the three institutions that was not evident for those that were participating and that were not previously socialized with European politics. And now here you had on the stage people, for example, Guy Verhofstadt in the European Parliament being very pushy and saying, no, we need treaty change convention and so on. And saying, well, but the council is blocking it. And then the council saying, well, you know, I mean, we are supporting what the commission is doing in most of the policy initiatives, but yes, there's no appetite between member states to do this or that, to open the door of a convention and treaty change and so on. And the commission playing a little bit that role
the honest broker, the middle. Take
exactly
the role in the middle between those two extremes.
So all that was fascinating, but in some ways I think that much of that would probably have been helpful to have it earlier, so that those conflicts and those positions were clear a little bit from the beginning. The feedback event as such was interesting, but at the same time, it was overwhelmingly led by the institutions. So the position of the citizens was more that of a listener, to put it like that, that could pose questions and so on. To put an example, the three institutions would first speak, then you would gather the questions from six citizens or seven citizens, and then the institutions would reply, but they would cherry pick what they were replying on. And in the end, there were many questions that were left unanswered, and in some ways was a sort of comfortable position for institutions to position themselves.
Right. And they can be seen to have consulted with the citizens and brought them back, and without necessarily being accountable to the citizens in a kind of in a strong way.
I would argue yes. I think they did an effort, but in some ways it fell a bit short, in the sense that, for example, from the commission side, Ursula von der Leyen was initially scheduled to participate, but in the end she didn't. However, you had three vice presidents, Sefcovic, Skinas, and Switcha. From the council, you would only have the Minister for EU Affairs of the Czech Republic, which currently holds the presidency, Mikuláš Bek. And from the parliament, you would have a lot of people, led by first the president of the parliament that gave like an introduction in the beginning, an opening, Roberta Metsola. And then you would have rotating MEPs that would appear often. So also it was in the parliament. So in some ways it makes more sense that there's more representation of MEPs and so on. But I think there's also already an indication that the president of the commission is not there and that the council is in many ways underrepresented in the sense that there was only one person from it. So I think that already said something. And to be fair, the person Mikuláš Bek from the council was I think fairly consistent and was explaining in a very pedagogical way why the council is unlikely to consider the treaty change or opening of a convention at the moment. There's just there's no consensus in the council. But I think that the citizens were positioned in a way that was relatively comfortable for institutions.
Well, now I'm conscious, Alvaro, of the time. I'll just ask a final wrap-up question. What is your final kind of reflection on the whole process of the conference and what, whether broadly speaking, it was a positive and whether you think that there's going to be good effects coming out of it and where do we go from here?
So I think the main pitfall of the whole conference is that basically it has been unable to engage in European politics people that were not previously socialized, other than the 800 randomly selected citizens. So the visibility and the public sphere was not there. The media did barely reported on it. National parliaments were, you know, as we discussed, broadly absent. Civil society organizations were a little bit sidelined, so they had very little incentives to talk too much about the conference and to organize a lot of things related to the conference. And broadly, there was no public debate related to the conference. So ultimately, the legitimacy of all the policies and all the discussions of the conference, I think, is harmed heavily by that, by the fact that not many people beyond the usual suspects were involved in the conference. So I think that's something that the institutions are clearly aware. At the same time, I am not sure that the upcoming citizen panels are likely to engage and have a broader societal debate. And we'll see that very soon, because in 2 weeks we have the first session of the first panel on food waste. But I'm fairly skeptical of that. So I think while citizen participation, I think is a very important dimension of democracy, I think it's also as well very important to engage all the mediating actors, be it civil society, be it trade unions, be it political parties, to avoid the sort of depoliticization of the process. I think that's what I'm in some ways afraid of, how sometimes citizen participation is in some ways individualizes participation rather than encouraging actors to organize in trade unions, in civil society spaces, to also contest what institutions are saying and doing. And I think this was a bit missing throughout the conference, this more contestatory element that would have triggered a little bit of broader public debate.
That's a fascinating reflection to end on, and I can't thank you enough. We've been talking for I think an hour, and it's been really fascinating for me, Alvaro Oleart. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for your reflections.
Thanks so much, Ian. A pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to Amplify, which was made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute in association with the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano.